Hello and welcome back to the Book Club Commune with me, your host, Ivy Poesy. We're back, we're refreshed, and we're starting a new book. We are getting into the, it really kind of goes without saying, but we're reading Imperialism, the Highest Stage of Capitalism by Lenin. I think it's a really good one. I'm just fucking full, disclosure right here. When we reach charts, which we will reach charts in the next episode, when we reach chapter 2, I am going to be summarizing them. I am not reading them verbatim. I'm either going to summarize them, or I'm going to look at them, decide that they're not important, and just skip over them. Because the charts, I'm not doing it. It just does not translate to audio very well. So yeah, we're doing Imperialism. Probably going to be one chapter per episode. Lenin's got an editor. It's going to be great. I'm looking forward to it. Let's get into chapter 1, titled Concentration of Production and Monopolies. Chapter 1, Concentration of Production and Monopolies. The enormous growth of industry and the remarkably rapid process of concentration of production in ever larger enterprises represents one of the most characteristic features of capitalism. Modern consensus of production give complete and exact information on this process. In Germany, for example, for every 1,000 industrial enterprises, large enterprises, i.e. those employing more than 50 workers, numbered 3 in 1882. In 6 in 1895, 9 in 1907, and out of every 100 workers employed, this group of enterprises on the dates mentioned employed 22, 30, and 37 respectively. Concentration of production, however, is much more intense than the concentration of workers, since labor in the large enterprises is much more productive. This is shown by the figures available on steam and electric motors. If we take what in Germany is called industrial in the broad sense of the term, that is, including commerce, transport, etc., we get the following picture. Large-scale enterprises are about 30,588 out of a total of 3,265,625. That is to say, 0.09%. These large-scale enterprises employ 5.7 million workers out of a total of 14.4 million. That is 39.4%. They use 6.6 million steam horsepower out of the total of 8.8. That is 75.3%. And 1.2 million kilowatts of electricity out of a total of 1.5 million. That is 77.2%. Less than 1/100 of the total enterprises utilize more than 3/4 of the steam and electrical power. 2,970,000 small enterprises, employing up to 5 workers, representing 91% of the total, utilize only 7% of the steam and electric power. Tens of thousands of large-scale enterprises are everything. Millions of small ones are nothing. In 1907, there were in Germany 586 establishments employing 1,000 and more workers. They employed nearly 1/10, 1.38 million, of the total workers employed in the industry and utilized almost 1/3, 32% of the total steam and electrical power employed. As we shall see, money capital and banks made this superiority, a handful of the largest enterprises, still more overwhelming in the literal sense of the word, since millions of small, medium, and even some big masters are in fact in complete subjugation to some hundreds of millionaire financiers. In another advanced country of modern capitalism, the United States, the growth of concentration of production is still greater. Here, statistics single out industry in the narrow sense of the word, and group of enterprises according to the value of their annual output in 1904 in the United States. Large-scale enterprises with an annual output of $1 million and over 1,900 out of 216,180, that is 0.09%. These employed 1.4 million workers out of 5.5 million, i.e. 25.6%, and their combined annual output was valued at $6.5 billion out of a $14.8 billion, i.e. 38%. 5 years later, in 1909, the corresponding figures were large-scale enterprises, 3,060 out of 268,491, i.e. 1.1%, employing 2 million workers out of 6.6 million, i.e. 30%, producing $9 billion out of $20.7 billion, i.e. 43.8%. Almost half of the total production of all the enterprises of the country was carried on a hundredth part of those enterprises. These 3,000 giant enterprises embraced 268 branches of industry. From this it can be seen that a certain stage of its development, concentration itself, as it were, leads right to monopoly. For a score of or so of giant enterprises can easily arrive at an agreement, while on the other hand, the difficulty of competition and the tendency towards monopoly arise from different dimensions of the enterprises. This transformation of competition into monopoly is one of the most important, if not the most important, phenomena of the modern capitalist economy, and we must deal with it in greater detail. But first, we must clear up one possible misunderstanding. American statistics say 3,000 giant enterprises and 250 branches of industry, as if it were only a dozen large-scale enterprises for each branch of industry. But this is not the case. Not in every branch of industry are there large-scale enterprises. And moreover, a very important feature of capitalism in its highest stage of development is the so-called combine, that is to say, the grouping in a single enterprise of different branches of industry, which represent either the consecutive stages of the working up of raw materials, for example, the smelting of iron ore into pig iron, the conversion of pig iron into steel, and then perhaps the manufacture of steel goods, or are auxiliary to one another, for example, the utilization of waste or of byproducts, the manufacture of packing materials, etc. Quote, combination, writes Hilferding, levels out the fluctuations of trade and therefore assures to the level of enterprises a more stable rate of profit. Secondly, combination has the effect of eliminating trading. Thirdly, it has the effect of rendering possible technical improvements and consequently the acquisition of super profits over and above those attained by the pure, i.e. non-combine enterprises. Fourthly, it strengthens the position of the combined enterprises compared with that of pure enterprises. It increases their competitive power in periods of serious depression when the fall of prices in raw materials does not keep pace with the fall of prices in manufactured articles. End quote. The German bourgeois economist Heymann, who has written a book especially on mixed, that is, combined enterprises in the German iron industry, says, quote, non-combined enterprises perish, crushed by the high price of raw materials and the low price of the finished product, end quote. Thus, we get the following picture. Quote, there remain, on the one hand, the great coal companies producing millions of tons yearly, strongly organized in their local coal syndicate, and closely connected with them, the big steel plants and their steel syndicate, and these great enterprises producing 400,000 tons of steel per annum, and correspondingly extensive coal, ore, and blast furnace operations, as well as the manufacturing of finished goods, employing 10,000 workers quarterly in company houses, sometimes owning their own wharves and railways, are today the standard type of German iron and steel plant. And concentration continues. Individual enterprises are becoming larger and larger. Ever increasing number of enterprises in one given industry or in several different industries join together in giant combines, backed up and controlled by half a dozen Berlin banks. In the German mining industry, the truth of the teachings of Karl Marx on the concentration of capital is definitely proved. At any rate, in a country where it is protected by tariffs and freight rates, the German mining industry is ripe for expropriation. End quote. Such is the conclusion which a conscientious bourgeois economist, and such are exceptional, had to arrive at. It must be noted that he seems to place Germany in a special category because their industries are protected by high tariffs. But the concentration of industry and the formation of monopolist manufacturers, combines, cartels, syndicates, etc., could only be accelerated by these circumstances. It is extremely important to note that free trade in England, concentration also led to monopoly, although somewhat later and perhaps in another form. Professor Herman Levy, in his special investigation entitled Monopolies, Cartels, and Trusts, based on data on British economic development, writes as follows. Quote, in Great Britain, it is the size of the enterprise and its capacity which harbor a monopolist tendency. This, for one thing, is due to the fact that the great investment of capital per enterprise, once the concentration movement has commenced, gives rise to increasing demands for new capital and for the new enterprises, and thereby renders their launching more difficult. Moreover, this seems to us to be the more important point. Every new enterprise that wants to keep pace with the gigantic enterprises that have arisen on the basis of the process of concentration produces such an enormous quantity of surplus goods that it can only dispose of them either by being able to sell them profitably as a result of enormous increase in demand, or by immediately forcing down prices to a level that would be unprofitable for both and for the monopoly combines. End quote. In England, unlike other countries where the protective tariffs facilitate the formation of cartels, monopolist alliances of entrepreneurs, cartels, and trusts arise in the majority of cases when only a number of competing enterprises is reduced to a couple dozen or so. Quote, hence the influence of the concentration movement on the formation of large industrial monopolies in the whole sphere of industry stands out with crystal clarity, end quote. 50 years ago, when Marx was writing Capital, free competition appeared to most economists to be the natural law. The official scientists tried, by a conspiracy of silence, to kill the works of Marx, which, by a theoretical and historical analysis of capitalism, showed that free competition gives rise to the concentration of production, which in turn, at a certain stage of development, leads to monopoly. Today, monopoly has become a fact. And economists are writing mountains of books in which they describe the diverse manifestations of monopoly and continue to declare in chorus that Marxism is refuted. But facts are stubborn things, as the English proverb says, and they have to be reckoned with whether we like it or not. The facts show that differences between capitalist countries, e.g. in the matter of production, protection, or free trade, only gives rise to insignificant variations in the form of monopolies, or in the moment of their appearance, and the rise of monopolies as the result of the concentration of production is the general and fundamental law of the present stage of development for capitalism. For Europe, the time when the new capitalism was definitely substituted for the old can be established fairly precisely. It was the beginning of the 20th century. In one of the latest compilations of the history of the formation of monopolies, we read, quote, a few isolated examples of capitalist monopoly could be cited from the period preceding 1860. In these could be discerned the embryo of the forms that are common today, but all undoubtedly represent prehistory. The real beginning of modern monopoly goes back at its earliest to the 60s. The first important period of development of monopoly commenced with the international industrial depression of the 70s and lasted until the beginning of the 90s. If we examine the question of a European scale, we will find that the development of free competition reached its apex in the 60s and 70s. Then it was that England completed and constructed of its old-style capitalist organization. In Germany, this organization had entered into a decisive struggle with handicraft and domestic industry, and had begun to create for itself its own forms of existence. End quote. Start of a new quote. The great revolutionization commenced with the crash of 1873, or rather, the depression which followed it, and which had hardly discernible interruptions in the early 80s and the unusually violent but short-lived boom around 1889, marks 22 years of European economic history. During the short boom of 1889 to 90, the system of cartels was widely resorted to be in order to take advantage of the favorable business conditions. An ill-considered policy drove prices still higher than would have been the case otherwise, and nearly all these cartels perished ingloriously in the smash. Another 5-year period of bad trade and low prices followed, but a new spirit reignited the industry. The Depression was no longer regarded as something to be taken for granted. It was regarded as nothing more than a pause before another boom. End that quote. New quote. The cartel movement entered its second epoch. Instead of being a transitory phenomenon, the cartels became one of the foundations of economic life. They are winning one field after another, primarily the raw materials of industry. At the beginning of the 90s, the cartel system had already acquired in the organization of the Coke Syndicate, on the model of which the Coal Syndicate was later formed, a cartel technique which could hardly be improved. For the first time, the great boom at the close of the 19th century and the crisis of 1900 to 03 occurred entirely in the cartels, in the mining and iron industries at least, under the aegis of the cartels, sorry. And while at that time it appeared to be something novel, now the general public takes it for granted that large spheres of the economy have been, as a general rule, systematically removed from the realm of free competition. End quote. Back to Lenin. Thus, the principal stages of in the history of monopolies are the following. 1. 1860 to 70, the highest stage of the apex of development of free competition. Monopoly is hardly discernible in its embryonic stage. 2. After the crisis of 1873, a wide zone of development of cartels. But they are still the exception. They are not yet durable. They are still a transitory phenomenon. 3. The boom at the end of the 19th century and the crisis of 1900 to 03. Cartels are one of the foundations of the whole of economic life. Capitalism has been transformed into imperialism. Cartels have come to agreement on the conditions of sale, terms of payment, etc. They divide the markets among themselves. They fix the quantity of goods to be produced. They fix prices. They divide the profits among the various enterprises, etc. The number of cartels in Germany was estimated at about 250 in 1896 and 385 in 1905, and about 12,000 firms participating. But it is generally recognized that these figures are underestimations. From the statistics of German industry, and for 1907 we quoted above, it is evident that even 1,200 large enterprises most certainly utilize more than half the steam and electric power in the country. In the United States, the number of trusts in 1900 was 185, and in 1907, 250. American statisticians divide all enterprises into three categories, according to whether they belong to individuals, private firms, or to corporations. These latter in 1909 comprised 23.6%, and in 1909, 25.9%, i.e., more than one-fourth of the total industrial enterprises in the whole country. These employed in 1904 70.6%, and in 1909 75.6%, i.e. more than 3/4 of the total wage earners. Their output amounted to, at these two dates, to 10.9 billion and 16.3 billion respectively, a 73.7% from 73.7% to 79% of the total. Not infrequently, cartels and trusts concentrate in their hands 7 or 8 tenths of the total output of a given branch of industry. The Rhine-Westphalian Coal Syndicate, at its foundation of 1893, controlled 86.7% of the total coal output in the area. 1910, it controlled 95.4%. But not the monopoly so created ensures enormous profits and leads to the formation of technical productive units. The formation formidable magnitude. The famous Standard Oil Company in the United States was founded in 1900. Quote, it has authorized capital of $150 million. It issued $100 million worth of common shares and $106 million worth of preferred shares. From 1900 to 07, they earned the following dividends. 48, 48, 45, 44, 36, 40, 40, 40% in the respective years, i.e., in all, 367 million. From 1882 to 1907, the Standard Oil Company made clear profits to the amount of 889 million, of which 606 million were distributed in dividends, and the rest went to reserve capital. In 1907, the various enterprises of the United States Steel Corporation employed no less than 200 110,180 workers and other employees. The largest enterprise in the German mining industry, the Gelsenkirchen Mining Company, employed in 1908 46,048 wage earners. End quote. In 1902, the United States Steel Corporation produced 9 million tons of steel. Its output constituted in 1901 66.3% and in 1908 56.1% of the total output of steel in the United States. Its share of the output of mineral ore increased from 43.9% to 46.3% of the total output in the same period. The report of the American Government Commission on the Trust states, quote, "Their superiority over their competitors is due to the magnitude of their enterprise and their excellent technical equipment. Since its inception, the Tobacco Trust devoted all of its efforts to the substitution of mechanical for manual labor on an extensive scale. With this end in view, it brought up all patents that had anything to do with the manufacture of tobacco and spent enormous sums for this purpose. Many of these patents first proved to be of no use and had to be modified by the engineers employed by the trust. At the end of 1906, two subsidiary companies were formed solely to acquire patents. With the same object in view, the trust built its own foundries, machine shops, and repair shops. One of these establishments in Brooklyn employs on the average 300 workers. Their experiments are carried out on inventions concerning the manufacture of cigarettes, cheroots, snuff, tinfoil for packing, boxes, etc. Here, also, inventions are perfected." End quote. Start of a new quote. "Other trusts employ so-called developing engineers, whose business it is to devise new methods of production, think out new production processes, and to test technical improvements. The United States Steel Corporation grants big bonuses to its workers and engineers for all innovations suitable for raising technical efficiency, for improving machinery, and for reducing costs of production." End quote. In German large-scale industry, e.g. the chemical industry, which has developed so enormously during the last few decades, the production of technical improvements is organized in the same way. In 1908, the process of concentration had already given rise to two main groups, which, in their way, had come close to being monopolies. First of these groups represented dual alliances of two pairs of big factories, each having a capital of from 20 to 21 million marks. On the other hand, the former Meister factory of Höchst and the Kassel factory at Frankfurt on Main, and on the other hand, the aniline and soda factory at Ludwigshafen and the former Bayer factory at Elberfeld. In 1905, one of these groups and in 1908, the other group, each concluded a separate agreement with yet another factory. The result was a formation of two triple alliances, each with a capital of from 40 to 50 million marks. And these alliances began to come close to one another to reach an understanding about prices, etc. Competition becomes transformed into monopoly. The result is immense progress in the socialization of production. In particular, the process of technical invention and improvement becomes socialized. This is no longer the old type of free competition between manufacturers, scattered and out of touch with one another, and producing for an unknown market. Concentration has reached the point where it is possible to make an approximate estimate of all sources of raw materials, for example, the iron ore deposits of a country, and even, as we shall see, of several countries, or of the whole world. Not only are such estimates made, but these sources are captured by gigantic monopolist alliances. An approximate estimate of the capacity of markets is also made, and the trusts divide them up among themselves by agreement. Skilled labor power is monopolized. The best engineers are engaged. The means of transport are captured. Railways in America, shipping companies in Europe and America. Capitalism in its imperial stage arrives at the threshold of the most complete socialization of production. In spite of themselves, the old capitalists are dragged, as it were, into the new social order, which marks the transition from complete free trade competition to complete socialization. Production becomes social, but appropriation remains private. The social means of production remain the private property of a few. The framework of formally recognized free competitions remains but the yoke of a few monopolists on the rest of the population. Becomes 100 times heavier and more burdensome and intolerable. The German economist Kestner has written a book especially on the subject of the struggle between the cartels and the outsiders, i.e. enterprises outside the cartels. He entitled his work Compulsory Organization, although in order to present capitalism in its true light, should have given it the title Compulsory Submission to Monopolist Combines. This book is edifying, if only for the list it gives of the modern and civilized methods that monopolist combines resort to in their striving towards organization. They are as follows. 1. Stopping supplies of raw materials, one of the most important methods of compelling adherence to the cartels. 2. Stopping the supply of labor by means of alliances, i.e. of agreements between employers and the trade unions, which, by the latter, permit their members to work only in trustified enterprises. 3. Cutting off deliveries. 4. Closing off trade outlets. 5. Agreements with buyers, by which the latter undertake to trade only with the cartels. 6. The systematic lowering of prices to ruin outside firms, i.e. those who refuse to submit to the trust. Millions are spent in order to sell goods for a certain time below the price, their cost price. The price of benzene was thus lowered from 40 to 22 marks, i.e. reduced by almost half. 7. Stopping credits. 8. Boycott. This is no longer competition between small and large-scale industry, or between technically developed and backward enterprises. We see here the monopolies throttling those which do not submit to them, to their yoke, to their dictation. The following is the ways in which the process is reflected in the mind of a bourgeois economist. Even in purely economic spheres, writes Kestner, a certain change is taking place from commercial activity in the old sense of the word to organizational speculative activity. The greatest success no longer goes to the merchant, whose technical and commercial experience enables him, best of all, to estimate the needs of the buyer, and, so to say, to discover latent demand. It goes to the speculative genius, by Lenin, who knows how to estimate in advance, or even only to sense the organizational development and possibilities of connection between individual enterprises and the banks. End quote. Translated into ordinary human language, this means that the development of capitalism has arrived at a stage when, although commodity production still reigns and continues to be regarded as the basis of economic life, it has in reality been undermined, and the big profits go to the genius of financial manipulation. At the basis of these swindles and manipulation lies socialized production, but the immense progress of humanity, which achieved the socialization, entirely goes to the benefit of speculators. We shall see later how, on these grounds, reactionary petty bourgeois critics of capitalist imperialism dream of taking a step backward and of return to free, peaceful, and honest competition. The prolonged raising of prices, which results from the formation of cartels, says Kestner, has hitherto been observed only in relation to the most important means of production, such as coal, iron, and potassium, and has never been observed for any length of time in relation to manufactured goods. Similarly, the increase in profits resulting from that has been limited only to the industries which produce means of production. To this observation, we must add that the raw materials industry secure advantages from the cartel formation not only in regard to growth of income and profitableness, but to the detriment of the finished goods industry, but also a dominating position of the latter, which did not exist under free competition. End quote. The words which we have italicized, I didn't, you read the book yourself, reveal the essence of the case which the bourgeois economists admit so rarely and so unwillingly, and which the modern defenders of opportunism, led by K. Kautsky, so zealously tried to evade and brush aside. Domination and violence that is associated with it, such are the relationships that are most typical of the latest phase of capitalist development. This is what must inevitably result and has resulted from the formulation of all-powerful economic monopolies. We will give more than one example of the methods employed by monopolies. It is particularly easy for cartels and monopolies to arise when it is possible to capture all the sources of raw materials, or at least the most important of them. It would be wrong, however, to assume that monopolies do not arise in other industries in which it is impossible to corner the source of raw materials. The cement industry, for example, can find its raw material anywhere. Yet in Germany, it is strongly trustified. The cement manufacturers have formed regional syndicates, South German, Rhine-Westphalian, etc. The prices are fixed at monopoly prices, 230 to 280 marks a carload, at the cost price of 180 marks. The enterprises pay a dividend from 12% to 16%, and let us not forget that the geniuses of modern speculation know how to pocket big profits besides those they draw from the dividends. Now, in order to prevent competition in such a profitable industry, the monopolies resort to sundry stratagems. For example, they spread disquieting rumors about the situation of their industry. Anonymous warnings are published in the newspapers like the following. Investors, don't place your capital in the cement industry. They buy up outsiders, those outside the trust, and pay them indemnities of 60,000 to 80,000, even 150,000 marks. Monopoly hews a path for itself without scruple as to the means, from modestly buying off competitors to the American device of employing dynamite against them. The stratagem that cartels can abolish crises is a fable spread by bourgeois economists who at all costs desire to place capitalism in a favorable light. On the contrary, when monopoly appears in certain branches of industry, it increases and intensifies the anarchy inherent in capitalist production as a whole. The disparity between the development of agriculture and that of industry, which is characteristic of capitalism, is increased. The privileged position of the most highly trustified industry, i.e. those so-called heavy industry, especially coal and iron, causes still a greater lack of concerted organization in other branches of production. As Jidels, the author of one of the best works in the relationship of the German big banks industry, puts it. Quote, the more developed the economic system in, writes Leifman, one of the most unblushing apologists of capitalism, the more it resorts to risky enterprises, or enterprises abroad, to those which need only a great deal of time to develop, or increase to those which are only of local importance, end quote. The increased risk is connected, in the long run, with the prodigious increase of capital, which overflows the brim, as it were, and flows abroad, etc. At the same time, the extremely rapid rate of technological progress gives rise more and more to disturbances in coordination between the various spheres of industry, to anarchy and crisis. Leifman is obliged to admit that, quote, in all probability mankind will see further imported technical revolutions in the near future, which will also affect the economic system. For example, electricity and aviation. As a general rule, in such a period of radical economic change, speculation becomes rife. End quote. Crises of every kind, economic crises more frequently, but not only these, in their turn increased very considerably the tendency towards concentration and monopoly. In this connection, the following reflections of Jidels on the crisis of 1900, which was, as we've already seen, the turning point in the history of modern monopoly, are exceedingly instructive. Quote, side by side with the giant plants in the basic industries, the crisis of 1900 found many plants organized on lines that today would be considered obsolete, the pure, non-combined plants, which would have also arisen on the crest of the industrial boom. The fall in prices and the falling off of demand put these pure enterprises in a precarious position, but did not affect some of the big combined enterprises at all, and affected only others for a very short time. As a consequence of this, the crisis of 1900 resulted in a far greater concentration of industry than the former crises, like that of 1873. The latter crises also produced a sort of selection of the best-equipped enterprises, but owing to the level of technical development at the time, this selection could not place the firms with which solely emerged from the crisis in a position of monopoly. Such a durable monopoly exists to a high degree in the gigantic enterprises in the present iron and steel and electric industries, and to a lesser degree in the engineering industry and certain metal transport and other enterprises. In consequence of their complicated technique, their extensive organization, and the magnitude of their capital. End quote. Monopoly. This is the last word in the latest phase of capitalist development. But we shall only have a very insufficient, incomplete, and poor notion of the real power and significance of modern monopolies if we do not take into consideration the part played by the banks. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Book Club Commune. Next episode, we're going to be getting into Chapter 2, which was very well set up by Lenin, the banks, and their new role. You know, considering at the end of the chapter talking about, you know, going into the banks, makes sense we're going to talk about banks next. There are charts in this. Before I record next episode, I'm going to go and see how many of these charts are actually useful. So, just be prepared. Also, by the way, if I'm stuttering and, like, stopping over words, this is, like, my super old copy of The Essential Works of Lenin, edited by Henry M. Christman. I don't know if I can pronounce that name. I've been using this book for, like, two or three years. It is underlined to high hell, and to the point where I've made it difficult for myself to read this book now because of how horrible my underlining is. It just covers up some of the words, which is super great. And I'm going to distract myself because I have, like, little notes in the margins. So I'm going to distract myself thinking, oh, what did I write in the margins here? And just be prepared for me just to make mistakes as I, you know, hyper-distract myself. But as always, thank you so much for listening to this episode. Be sure to like and share this with your comrades out there, anyone who you think needs to have access to this work or this text. You know, I haven't read it in a while, but I remember it being a good one. I hope everyone else agrees. So yeah, solidarity forever, and keep on reading.